Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
If you are rearing children, you know how hard it is to find a way to follow that common advice, keep the lines of communication open. Even aside from the sometimes startling changes in your child's or adolescent's willingness to communicate, there is always the question of when. Your days are packed, their days are packed. If they aren't rushing to some activity, they're loaded down with homework or maybe just socializing with their friends. We've had many wonderful chats with Dr. Elizabeth Englander here on the Social Network Show about how parents, teachers, and school administrators can deal effectively and kindly with bullying and cyberbullying. After all, that is what she studies and writes about. Her book on the topic is called Bullying and Cyberbullying: What Every Educator Should Know. And it will provide you with insight that makes things simpler, not more complicated, whoever you are. Thank you for joining us today. This is your host, Jane Kawaski, Dr. J, and I've asked Dr. Englander to address that question of when can parents and other adults engage children and youngsters in conversation about the social problems they often face. You will then get an update on her latest research and learn which age group is currently facing the most cyber problems. Welcome back to the Social Network Show, Dr. Englander.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, would you mind telling us about your firsthand knowledge of raising kids?
Well, I have three kids myself, and I think it's fair to say that we live in a town that has very competitive school districts, so everybody's very academic-minded, and everybody's very busy. And I have a lot of sympathy, I think, for how difficult it can be to find a time to really sit down and connect with your kids.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Knowing that you have been able to see how things actually work out in day-to-day reality rather than just what it says in books, it sure gives
me... Right. That's right.
Yeah, your book is based on that day-to-day reality, but the confidence in your guidance is user-tested guidance. And I want to ask you what you can say in regard to how parents can find the opportunity to communicate with kids. But first, when we say communicate, this often seems to imply deep, serious talks or the talk. Is that the type of communication you're talking about here?
Definitely not. You know, the good thing about communicating with kids is that any effort counts, whether it's deep or not. Everything counts. So a lot of times a parent will say to me something like, well, I tried to talk with my daughter or my son about what they're doing online, and all I get back is a grunt. Or they say, everything's fine, Mom, and they don't want to talk about it. You know, and it's, they're trying to engage, but they're finding that their kids aren't really responding the way they hoped they would. Mm-hmm. And one of the things to realize is that kids interpret these kinds of things differently from adults. So your child isn't scoring you on how successful you are at engaging them in a really big, long, meaningful conversation. They just want to know that you care. Mm-hmm. So that's what they're really focused on is, does she care? Does he care? And if you ask what's going on, if you inquire about what they're up to or any problems they might be having or how they're doing with their friends, all of those questions really give your kids the feeling that you're interested in their lives, you're interested in knowing what's going on, and you care about what's happening. And so even if they don't respond at the moment, you're still making progress, because now if they do have a problem, they're going to be more likely to come to you because you've sort of expressed that interest in what's going on in their life. So I don't think it matters completely whether or not you have long, deep conversations. I think the important thing is to show an interest regularly and to ask questions. And then those conversations may or may not come up, but they're much more likely to happen once you've shown that kind of interest.
Well, a lot of times I think, too, if there's too much buildup or, you know, it's made too big of a deal of, that really kind of puts the lid on it, you know, it kind of squelches it. But
definitely, and I think it scares kids a little bit. You know, they're, of course, every child's first thought is, am I in trouble? Have I done something wrong? Is that why you look so serious? But also, you're right. It makes the whole thing seem scarier and more sort of fraught with danger. Whereas if it's a common thing, if it's a regular situation where you're regularly getting the chance to say, how are things going? What are you going to do with your friends tomorrow? Do you have any plans this weekend? How's so-and-so doing? Those kinds of conversations are ones where you're saying to your child, I really care about what's happening in your life, and I really want to know, but this is not, you know, I'm not doing this because I'm targeting you for some big, heavy topic.
I can imagine myself, you know, in this scenario of driving kids to their next engagement. The chauffeur is a common role, I think, for a lot of parents. Mm-hmm. And that, oh, well, that might be a good opportunity. And then I look over, and guess what? Everybody's on their cell phone.
Right.
So.
Well, that brings me to one of the opportunities, I think, that we have. So one of the rules that I have with my kids when they get a little bit older is that if they want to sit in the front seat of the car, there are no devices allowed in the front seat of the car. The front seat of the car is a place to have conversation or to talk or to listen to music, but it's not a place for devices. And that works pretty well because all kids want to sit in the front. When they're starting to be about 11 or 12 and they're getting near the age where it's legal for them to sit in the front seat, they all want to sit in the front. And they see it as sort of an adult privilege. Mm. And what you're doing is you're defining it as a place where you don't ignore the person who's sitting next to you and stick your nose in your phone, but instead you actually have a conversation. And the other advantage of this particular rule, apart from that it carves out these times to just chat about things, is once your children get old enough to begin driving themselves, then they've already associated the front seat as a place where there are no devices. And and they may be less likely to do things like text while they drive or talk on the phone, things like that.
Yeah. Well, that would be a great side effect. And, okay, so if I'm listening to the show and I think, well, that's great. I should have done that 5 years ago because my kids are now, you know, in the teen years. How can you broach that subject? How would you put it in words to where you want it? Can you do it at that point? Or, you know, the no devices? Or if there's just tremendous resistance, what do you suggest?
Well, the first thing is that I don't think it's always better to start earlier, but I think you can start any time broaching these subjects. But as you pointed out, Dr. J, you really want to go easy on this. You don't want to make it seem a big deal, and you want to try to do it regularly. So the other rule of talking to your kids is about thinking about your priorities of time. So, for example, there are activities that take place right around the time that most families sit down to dinner. Mm-hmm. And you have to really think about what's important. I think one of the hard things about being a parent today is that you sort of feel like your children should be, you know, playing in Carnegie Hall on their piano by the time they're 13 years old, you know, or on an Olympic team for a sport, you know, or you feel like there should be so much achievement in these extracurricular activities that you feel horrible if you deprive them of any of them. But it's kind of a matter of thinking about what your priorities are. So what do we know about sitting down together at dinner as a family? What do we know about that? What has the research shown us about that? What it's shown us is that kids who are parts of families where they sit down and talk at dinner do better in a lot of different ways. They do better emotionally. They do better socially. They're more connected to their family. They're more emotionally close with their parents and with their siblings. They get along better. And they develop better social skills overall than kids whose families don't have dinner together.
Interesting.
So that makes it hard because then you have to sit down and say, well, you know, I could have them do this activity or I could have them have dinner with us every night.
Right.
And then you have to choose. And that's not, that may sound on paper like an easy choice, but it's in, you know, I was faced with choices like that myself, and it's not an easy choice.
Uh-huh.
It's not an easy choice. These are very difficult choices to make because you feel horrible if you say to your child, well, you can't do this activity. Instead, we're going to eat dinner together. You feel like you're depriving them of something. But on the other hand, if you don't sit down, I think it's very clear by now that if you don't sit down and have dinner as often as possible with your family, you are also seriously depriving your kids. So it's sort of a matter of where your priorities are. For me personally, it came down to family dinner. And so, you know, starting very early on when my oldest was in kindergarten, he became part of a wonderful karate program. It was very child developmentally oriented. He was really good at it. It was great, but it met at 5 or 6 o'clock every night.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't do it. And that wasn't an easy choice to make. It was really hard. I really thought that he benefited from this program. And it was really hard to say, well, we're just not going to do it because it happens during dinner time.
That I can appreciate that that would be, it's a deep one. And like you say, it does go into, I can just imagine parents having a values clarification session, you know, to figure out because these are going to be kind of difficult situations or conditions and decisions, what, you know, where's our center? What do we really believe? What do we really want? And what is the value?
Right.
And compare the value of those, you know, like you say, if it's that crucial for social development, well, that's what we're all distressed about, is that the conditions that are so bad online or in schools, it's because kids don't have social skills. So this is a very high need to develop. But tell me this, what if in a particular family situation, the family dinner just isn't an option? I mean, maybe dad works swing shift or mom does and, you know, kids are at latchkey or something. What are some other options? I suppose there's other meals, but do you have any other thoughts?
Sure, sure. There are other meals. So you can carve out things like Sunday, like brunch, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You can also do dinners that don't involve one person. So if one parent has to work late, the other parent can do a family dinner with the kids. It's not as good, but it's a lot better than nothing.
Well, and of course,
you know,
many...
And you have to, and I think the key is to really enforce the time talking together. So that means that one of the rules about digital devices is that there are none at the table.
Mm-hmm.
None. Not even face down, and you don't answer the home phone. This is just a time to sit and talk. It doesn't even have to be very long. A lot of family dinners seem to be about 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, they're really, really important to kids. And they may be the only time that everybody sits down together. So anybody who's there, you should do it with. And you should think about your priorities when you're making choices or permitting your kids to do activities. It's very hard to say no to a child who wants to do an activity that's going to interfere with dinner. But at the same time, you're teaching them about how important the family is.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you can't do family dinner and you say, okay, we're going to do Sunday brunch every morning. And your child says, well, I have an opportunity to be on this team, but if I do it, I'll never be here on Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say to a child, you know something, We don't get to eat dinner together. It's really important that we sit down together once a week on Sundays and say hello. And it's hard to tell them that they can't, but you're also saying to them, look, this is important. This matters. Our family life matters together, how we feel about each other and how much time we spend together. These things are really important for development. They're not small things. They're big things. And that's what you're teaching your kids, and that's what they're going to take with them when they become parents. They're going to be that much more committed to their families because you've taught them how important families are.
One thing that I remember from years ago is how something that's regular, even if it doesn't seem to be very much, can have a tremendous effect. And I remember one man telling me about his son. He says, you give him a nickel's worth of love, he gives you a dollar back in change.
Mm-hmm.
So that
absolutely
is the effects. And of course, like many of us, as we were growing up, we may not have shown much appreciation for certain things, but it does stick with you. And I often think that you may feel like you're just treading water, but think of it, you're not drowning. When you're treading water, that's pretty good. So,
and there are long-term payoffs. So you sort of have to have the courage of your convictions a little bit. You have to have the sense that, look, it might be a pain to say no to them about this activity, or it might be a pain to have to make dinner every night when you're tired and you don't want to. But at the same time, in the long term, that time together is going to pay off, and it's going to pay off in a big way. Another thing, by the way, another alternative to meals for families that really can't do it is doing things like taking vacations together or taking weekends away together.
Mm-hmm.
Taking periodic times where you go away and it's just your family. And you're sort of in enforced, contact with each other for an extended period of time. A lot of kids remember those times as some of the very happiest while they were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the kinds of things that can really be the glue that sort of holds the family together and teaches the kids how much it matters.
Great. You know what? Let's just give a little bit about the research that you'd been doing about the age of kids who are having the most cyber problems, you might say, and then we'll discuss it. We'll discuss it on another show, okay?
Okay. Well, this is a very large study. It has about 50,000 children in it. And the children are aged 8 to 18. And one of the things we do in this study is we track how behaviors change over the years, particularly the behaviors that they do online. So we've known since 2010 that the percentage of kids in elementary school and in middle and high school who have digital devices, who own them, is going up. That's not a big surprise, I think. And we've also known that in elementary school, owning a digital device is one of the risk factors for having some kind of problem online where somebody's mean to you or picks on you or does something that's embarrassing towards you. But what we found is that when we looked at problems online and being a victim online, that among the youngest kids, the kids aged 8 to 11, those were the only kids who were reporting more and more frequent problems online. The older kids, the teenagers, actually over the last 4 years have decreased the percentage that reported having problems. So I think what's happening is that older kids are getting information in school and they're reading things in the paper and they're getting information from their parents and they may be handling this all better than they did a few years ago. But the younger kids who are getting more and more devices are getting more and more contact and more problems, and they're much less likely to have any help with these issues at school or at home.
Okay, interesting. And we will discuss that more on another show. But for today, thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Englander of the Bridgewater, Massachusetts, Bridgewater State University in Massachusetts. Thanks, Elizabeth.
That's right. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining us on the Social Network Show. We appreciate your listening, and please tell your friends and family that are interested in social network issues to join us also.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show. the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. Coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on the Social Network show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.